You will hear three different speakers. The questions 1 to 6. Choose the answer, A, B, or C, which fits best according to what to hear. There are two questions for each excerpt. Now listen to part 1 and answer questions 1 to 6.
Extract 1.
Let me explain that 10-point plan, which operates on a scale of 1 hour.
A plan for selling, you mean?
Well, it's more than that. Mm. It's a complete strategic approach to the whole business, really. If you follow all the points in the plan, you can almost guarantee a sale in an hour. The important thing is preparation. Mm. First, identify your customer and make sure you prepare all the necessary paperwork. You can't make any kind of successful sale without it. Find out exactly where the customer lives. And before you go, check your appearance.
Sort of smart but casual?
Exactly. No way out scruffy clothes, but not too over the top. Then, the kit. You must take all the equipment you need for the demonstration. And you must look enthusiastic. And smile. Spend the first 2 minutes greeting the occupants of the house. This greeting stage is crucial, and don't prejudge what kind of people they might be. Of course, you'll hear the usual objections at the door, but just introduce yourself politely and remember to keep smiling.
Extract 2.
Until a few seasons ago, trainers were just smelly shoes for sport. But with fashion moving towards formal wear for both men and women, trainers have had to shape up and look luxurious. This season, my collection includes a plush leather trainer to wear with a suit. The leather soles are wafer thin, and the toes are shaped to a narrow point. Men want an essential style that fits in across the board, from casual to formal. But even the sports trainer isn't what it used to be. This year, one well-known sports giant's launching its latest technological revolution. Their new systems discarded the air pocket and replaced it with sprung supports in place of a conventional sole. Still, the influence of trainers on new styles remains strong. You could say that ready-to-wear designers have had their eyes on them ever since it became cool to wear them to the office. But with so many designers moving into the futuristic footwear market, the top sports brands might just have reason to worry. That's why shoe specialists with the right amount of technical know-how are fighting back.
Extract 3.
My latest songs just succeeded in climbing the international charts. The scale of the success is 100 times greater than anything I could have dreamed of. When I first went solo, I bought a few items of basic equipment and started my own studio. It was a big gamble, but I knew I had the talent to make a go of it if I worked hard enough. Almost immediately, things started to look up. I was asked to do 2 songs for the soundtrack of a new film, and the equipment gave a new momentum to my songwriting. But only 18 months ago, being on tour meant 7 of us in a van, with me taking my turn driving and helping to lug the gear in and out of halls. Now I've sold out an entire US tour, and it means several vehicles and a crew of about 30. It's difficult to get my head around, and that's before the financial rewards start to come through. But don't expect to hear songs about how tough it is to be a rich, multi-million selling star on my follow-up album. It's not so long since money was really tight for me, and nobody was listening to my music much, so my feet are still very much on the ground.
You will hear part 1 again.
Extract 1.
Let me explain that 10-point plan, which operates on a scale of 1 hour.
A plan for selling, you mean?
Well, it's more than that. Mm. It's a complete strategic approach to the whole business, really. If you follow all the points in the plan, you can almost guarantee a sale in an hour. The important thing is preparation. Mm. First, identify your customer and make sure you prepare all the necessary paperwork. You can't make any kind of successful sale without it. Find out exactly where the customer lives. And before you go, check your appearance.
Sort of smart
but casual?
Exactly. No way out scruffy clothes, but not too over the top. Then, the kit. You must take all the equipment you need for the demonstration. And you must look enthusiastic. And smile. Spend the first 2 minutes greeting the occupants of the house. This greeting stage is crucial. And don't prejudge what kind of people they might be. Of course, you'll hear the usual objections at the door, but just introduce yourself politely and remember to keep smiling.
Extract 2.
Until a few seasons ago, trainers were just smelly shoes for sport. But with fashion moving towards formal wear for both men and women, trainers have had to shape up and look luxurious. This season, my collection includes a plush leather trainer to wear with a suit. The leather soles are wafer thin, and the toes are shaped to a narrow point. Men want an essential style that fits in across the board, from casual to formal. But even the sports trainer isn't what it used to be. This year, one well-known sports giant's launching its latest technological revolution. Their new systems discarded the air pocket and replaced it with sprung supports in place of a conventional sole. Still, the influence of trainers on new styles remains strong. You could say that ready-to-wear designers have had their eyes on them ever since it became cool to wear them to the office. But with so many designers moving into the futuristic footwear market, the top sports brands might just have reason to worry. That's why shoe specialists with the right amount of technical know-how are fighting back.
Extract 3.
My latest song's just succeeded in climbing the international charts. The scale of the success is 100 times greater than anything I could have dreamed of. When I first went solo, I bought a few items of basic equipment and started my own studio. It was a big gamble, but I knew I had the talent to make a go of it if I worked hard enough. Almost immediately, things started to look up. I was asked to do 2 songs for the soundtrack of a new film, and the equipment gave a new momentum to my songwriting. But only 18 months ago, being on tour meant 7 of us in a van, with me taking my turn driving and helping to lug the gear in and out of halls. Now, I've sold out an entire US tour, and it means several vehicles and a crew of about 30. It's difficult to get my head around, and that's before the financial rewards start to come through. But don't expect to hear songs about how tough it is to be a rich, multi-million-selling star on my follow-up album. It's not so long since money was really tight for me, and nobody was listening to my music much, so my feet are still very much on the ground.
You'll hear a radio presenter called Robbie Everson talking about an international hospitality network known as Couchsurfing. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or a short phrase. Now you have some time to look at questions 7 to 15. Listen to part 2 and answer questions 7 to 15.
Hi there, I'm Ruby Everston, and on tonight's programme, we're looking at an international hospitality network that goes by the name Couchsurfing. It's an online resource that helps anyone travelling around the world to find free accommodation with local people. Basically, members offer overnight accommodation to travellers from other countries. This may actually be a spare bed if you've got one, but that's not obligatory. Just a sofa or floor space will do, hence the name Couchsurfing. In return, when you're travelling yourself, there's a network of beds, couches and floors around the world for you to take advantage of. Couchsurfing's actually been around for more than a decade, and the largest of the various websites has more than 9 million members signed up in over 120,000 destinations spread across 190 of the world's nation states. As you might imagine, the original target user was the backpacker or gap year student. And although 86% of couch surfers are still in the under 35 age bracket, people of all ages are now signed up. Couchsurfing started out as an aspect of what's called the gift economy. And like other non-profit and resource-sharing schemes, it's made possible by the internet. So how do you get involved? Well, first up, you go online and create a profile on the website of your choice. Obviously, you need to make both yourself and your accommodation sound attractive, but don't let your creativity and imagination get the better of you. Honesty is the best policy, backed up by lots of realistic photos. Some websites have social events where hosts in a locality meet up and compare notes. This kind of support network's important. Like, if you live somewhere off the beaten track, you could create what's known as a place page to encourage people to come and visit. Pooling resources for recommendations about eating out, sightseeing, etc. is also a good idea, because one of the big plus points of couchsurfing is that the host can provide tips and introductions in the local area. By the same token, when it's your turn to go out in search of a couch when you're travelling, careful reading of the member profiles is essential. Another aspect of the scheme is that members have to provide three safeguards. Firstly, personal references are an essential requirement. People who can vouch for the fact that you are who you say you are, that you're a reliable sort of person. Sites often also check your credit card details as a way of confirming your identity. And finally, there are the user reports that people write after staying with members. It's crucial to check these out before agreeing to go and stay with someone. So if you do join a scheme, a few points to remember. As a guest, tidiness and consideration are important. Always clean up after yourself. A present, however small, always goes down well, but flexibility is the real key to a happy stay. It is somebody else's home after all, so you need to fit in. And of course, finally, never overstay your welcome. Remember the old adage, it's lovely when guests come to stay, and it's equally lovely to see them go.
Now you will hear part two again.
Hi there, I'm Ruby Eversden, and on tonight's programme, we're looking at an international hospitality network that goes by the name Couchsurfing. It's an online resource that helps anyone travelling around the world to find free accommodation with local people. Basically, members offer overnight accommodation to travellers from other countries. This may actually be a spare bed if you've got one, but that's not obligatory. Just a sofa or floor space will do, hence the name Couchsurfing. In return, when you're travelling yourself, there's a network of beds, couches and floors around the world for you to take advantage of. Couchsurfing's actually been around for more than a decade, and the largest of the various websites has more than 9 million members signed up in over 120,000 destinations, spread across 190 of the world's nation states. As you might imagine, the original target user was the backpacker or gap year student. And although 86% of couch surfers are still in the under 35 age bracket, people of all ages are now signed up. Couchsurfing started out as an aspect of what's called the gift economy. And like other non-profit and resource-sharing schemes, it's made possible by the internet. So how do you get involved? Well, first up, you go online and create a profile on the website of your choice. Obviously, you need to make both yourself and your accommodation sound attractive, but don't let your creativity and imagination get the better of you. Honesty is the best policy, backed up by lots of realistic photos. Some websites have social events where hosts in a locality meet up and compare notes. This kind of support network's important. Like, if you live somewhere off the beaten track, you could create what's known as a place page to encourage people to come and visit. Pooling resources for recommendations about eating out, sightseeing, etc. is also a good idea, because one of the big plus points of couchsurfing is that the host can provide tips and introductions in the local area. By the same token, when it's your turn to go out in search of a couch when you're travelling, careful reading of the member profiles is essential. Another aspect of the scheme is that members have to provide three safeguards. Firstly, personal references are an essential requirement. People who can vouch for the fact that you are who you say you are, that you're a reliable sort of person. Sites often also check your credit card details as a way of confirming your identity. And finally, there are the user reports that people write after staying with members. It's crucial to check these out before agreeing to go and stay with someone. So if you do join a scheme, a few points to remember. As a guest, tidiness and consideration are important. Always clean up after yourself. A present, however small, always goes down well, but flexibility is the real key to a happy stay. It is somebody else's home after all, so you need to fit in. And of course, finally, never overstay your welcome. Remember the old adage, it's lovely when guests come to stay, and it's equally lovely to see them go.
You will hear an interview with Dr. Latford, a leading expert in the field of forensic science. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C, or D, which fits best according to what you hear. Now you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20.
Today in the studio we have Dr. Lafford from the Forensic Science Service, who is here to tell us a little more about forensic science.
Good morning.
Now, I think most people have a fairly good general picture of the kind of work you do. In many ways it's a development of Sherlock Holmes and his magnifying glass, isn't it?
Yes, you could put it that way. Although we've come a long way since then, of course. But Holmes was very much a detective of the modern age. Of course, he was an intelligent man, and his medical knowledge often seemed better than that of his companion, Dr. Watson. And certainly his observations were always very detailed. But what sets him apart is that Holmes provides us with a good model, a very good model, in fact, of the kind of approach, psychological approach, that a forensic scientist should have. And that is that the forensic scientist is absolutely impartial.
So you're not, strictly speaking, part of the police force?
No, we are quite separate.
Could you tell us a little about your work and what it is you do?
Well, the basic principle behind forensic science is that every contact leaves a trace. Wherever we go, whatever we touch, material is transferred both ways. The shoe that leaves a mark on the ground also picks up traces of dirt. And the hand that makes a fingerprint also carries away particles from the object that was handled. And things like hair or carpet fibres are easily passed from one person to another.
I see. So it's not just that the suspect leaves clues at the scene of the crime. The scene of the crime leaves clues on the suspect.
Absolutely. And that is normally the most compelling evidence. Not just when you have a fingerprint, for example, but also where you found traces of, say, the carpet at the scene of a crime on the suspect's clothing. And that, of course, can be very hard to explain away.
Is your work fairly straightforward? A question of seeing whether various samples match up?
No, not at all. Forensic science is often a very painstaking task and very time-consuming. Much more so than previously, in fact, because the range of tests has mushroomed. For example, we might be given some pieces of a headlight swept up after a hit-and-run accident and asked to identify the car. So we would fit the thousands of pieces together like a vast jigsaw and might be able to identify the number embossed on the back of the glass. That would help us identify the model of the car, the make, the age, and so on, making it easier to search for the suspect. And then, once the car was located, we could tell whether the lights had been on at the time of the accident by examining the light bulb, because there would be minute pieces of molten glass on the metal filament in the bulb.
So you need some fairly sophisticated equipment, as well as patience.
Indeed. Now, the electron microscope is invaluable in our line of work, and it basically does two things. It gives us a fantastically detailed image. So, for example, you can tell whether a piece of hair has been broken or cut with a pair of scissors or a knife. And it can also give you the chemical composition of a sample, so that you can take, perhaps, a tiny flake of paint on a suspect's clothing and match it with paint at the scene of the crime.
Are you at the stage, then, where you could say that the evidence that you provide is foolproof?
No, not foolproof. There is always room for human error, and there's nothing that can be done about that. Forensics is not an absolute science. I mean, let me give you an example. Now, Sherlock Holmes might have found a strand of hair at the scene of a crime, perhaps black and 2 inches long, that would have helped him identify the murderer on the basis that the hair matched the murderer's. Now, we also examine hair, but in the example I gave you, perhaps one person in 20 has black hair 2 inches long. So we need to improve on this analysis to narrow down the number of suspects. So we would analyze the strand of hair using the electron microscope, as I was saying earlier, look at its chemical composition, whether it came from a man or a woman, see how it was cut, whether it showed any traces of particular chemicals and so on. And in that way, instead of saying that one person in 20 had hair like that, it might be one person in 500,000 or a million. That would be just about as far as we could go. Now, there's no such thing as certainty, just a balance of probability, even with the most advanced techniques of genetic fingerprinting. The evidence we provide is there to be interpreted, and that's very important.
Well, Dr. Lafford, thank you very much. We'll take a break now, but stay with us, and we'll be back with an expert in the science of...
Now you will hear part 3 again.
Today in the studio, we have Dr. Lafford from the Forensic Science Service, who is here to tell us a little more about forensic science.
Good morning.
Now, I think most people have a fairly good general picture of the kind of work you do. In many ways, it's a development of Sherlock Holmes and his magnifying glass, isn't it?
Yes, you could put it that way. Although we've come a long way since then, of course. But Holmes was very much a detective of the modern age. Of course, he was an intelligent man, and his medical knowledge often seemed better than that of his companion, Dr. Watson. And certainly his observations were always very detailed. But what sets him apart is that Holmes provides us with a good model, a very good model, in fact, of the kind of approach, psychological approach, that a forensic scientist should have. And that is that the forensic scientist is absolutely impartial.
So you're not, strictly speaking, part of the police force?
No, we are quite separate.
Could you tell us a little about your work and what it is you do?
Well, the basic principle behind forensic science is that every contact leaves a trace. Wherever we go, whatever we touch, material is transferred both ways. The shoe that leaves a mark on the ground also picks up traces of dirt, and the hand that makes a fingerprint also carries away particles from the object that was handled. And things like hair or carpet fibers are easily passed from one person to another.
I see. So it's not just that the suspect leaves clues at the scene of the crime. The scene of the crime leaves clues on the suspect.
Absolutely. And that is normally the most compelling evidence. Not just when you have a fingerprint, for example, but also where you found traces of, say, the carpet at the scene of a crime on the suspect's clothing. And that, of course, can be very hard to explain away.
Is your work fairly straightforward? A question of seeing whether various samples match up?
No, not at all. Forensic science is often a very painstaking task and very time-consuming. Much more so than previously, in fact, because the range of tests has mushroomed. For example, we might be given some pieces of a headlight swept up after a hit-and-run accident and asked to identify the car. So we would fit the thousands of pieces together like a vast jigsaw and might be able to identify the number embossed on the back of the glass. That would help us identify the model of the car, the make, the age, and so on, making it easier to search for the suspect. And then once the car was located, we could tell whether the lights had been on at the time of the accident by examining the light bulb, because there would be minute pieces of molten glass on the metal filament in the bulb.
So you need some fairly sophisticated equipment, as well as patience.
Indeed. Now, the electron microscope is invaluable in our line of work, and it basically does two things. It gives us a fantastically detailed image. So, for example, you can tell whether a piece of hair has been broken or cut with a pair of scissors or a knife. And it can also give you the chemical composition of a sample, so that you can take, perhaps, a tiny flake of paint on a suspect's clothing and match it with paint at the scene of the crime.
Are you at the stage, then, where you could say that the evidence that you provide is foolproof?
No, not foolproof. There is always room for human error, and there's nothing that can be done about that. Forensics is not an absolute science. I mean, let me give you an example. Now, Sherlock Holmes might have found a strand of hair at the scene of a crime, perhaps black and 2 inches long, that would have helped him identify the murderer on the basis that the hair matched the murderer's. Now, we also examine hair, but in the example I gave you, perhaps one person in 20 has black hair 2 inches long. So we need to improve on this analysis to narrow down the number of suspects. So we would analyze the strand of hair using the electron microscope, as I was saying earlier, look at its chemical composition, whether it came from a man or a woman, see how it was cut, whether it showed any traces of particular chemicals and so on. And in that way, instead of saying that one person in 20 had hair like that, it might be one person in 500,000 or a million. That would be just about as far as we could go. Now, there's no such thing as certainty, just a balance of probability, even with the most advanced techniques of genetic fingerprinting. The evidence we provide is there to be interpreted, and that's very important.
Well, Dr. Lafford, thank you very much. We'll take a break now, but stay with us, and we'll be back with an expert in the science of...
That's the end of the task.